Welcome to the AlphaMind podcast with me, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall, where we discuss matters related to trading psychology, trading behavior, trading mindset, and so much more. Our guest this week is Tom Hugod. Tom is a high-stakes day trader and author of a superb new book, Best Loser Wins, Why Normal Thinking Never Wins a Trading Game, which focuses on the mental battle needed to succeed in trading and the challenge of getting your mind right. Tom is someone who has faced his own personal battles over many years to become a successful trader. Like many, he has gone through that cycle of try, learn, fail, try again, and eventually succeed. Tom is passionate about trading, as you will hear in this podcast, and he also loves helping others to learn. He runs an excellent Telegram channel called TraderTom.com, which has over 15,000 members. Before we start, we would like to thank our podcast partners, TradeStation Global and the Society of Technical Analysts. TradeStation Global is a multi-asset trading platform with access to international markets. Trade stocks, forex futures, and micro e-mini futures from one account. Leverage professional-grade tools like Radar Screen, The Matrix, and Easy Language, an intuitive coding language for traders. And with TradeStation Global, there are no hidden price spreads, just transparent, low commissions. To find out more and open an account, visit tradestationinternational.com/AlphaMind or see the link in the episode description. TradeStation International Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK and acts as an introducing broker to Interactive Brokers UK Limited. The firm does not provide investment advice or trading recommendations. Investment and trading involves risk, including possible loss of principal. At present, the TradeStation Global product is not available to EU residents. The Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, are another long-established organisation with a great reputation. They are a member-led and not-for-profit body who have been providing world-beating education to the trading and investment community for over five decades and serve the needs of their members by providing outstanding online talks and webinars, regular newsletters, education, diplomas, and continued professional development programs. Their home study course has been created by many of the world's leading minds in technical analysis and provides learning of a depth and breadth that is unparalleled in the trading and investing world. Listeners to the AlphaMind podcast can obtain a 10% discount on the cost of the STA home study course. Visit alpha-mind.net and go to the sponsor section of our page to find out how to obtain this. Now, on with this week's podcast.
Well, welcome to this week's Alpha Mind podcast. We're glad to have Tom Hugod with us. He's author of Best Loser Wins, which has been hitting the sales recently. I've been reading this book, and I don't normally stick a lot of stickers in the book, but I got a book that currently looks like a hedgehog. And I'm convinced that Tom's been following me around for some of my coaching because there's a few things in there that I recognize as well. Lovely, but it's such a huge backstory, and I'm not going to even dare to just talk about your bio, Tom, but I just want to welcome you to the show and just go for it. Tell us about yourself. Where have you come from? Where are you going? And what's your current state?
Okay. I am from Denmark. And where am I? I'm on a journey. And I have plateaued on that journey. I used to trade small size, 5-10 pounds a point. Obviously, that's going to be very familiar talk to people who are based in the United Kingdom and Euro, I imagine, where we don't trade contracts. I mentioned that because it's sponsored by TradeStation, and that tends to be futures contracts. But say a FTSE futures contract is 10 pounds a point, essentially. And we just have a different nomenclature in Europe where we can nominate the stake size instead. So we're still trading the same market. And I used to work for a brokerage in London called City Index. And I spent 10 years on the trading floor. And that in itself is an amazing experience because you get to be on the front seat of people's behavior. Now, initially, you just think, oh, okay, well, that guy's good and that guy's rubbish and so forth. But as the days and weeks and months roll by, you begin to see a bigger picture. And that bigger picture is the behavioral bigger picture. And I spent 10 years observing people's behavior through their interactions with financial markets. And that to me was a gift. It was a gift from God because I was able to sit and watch every single 5-minute bar for 10 years, and I truly did that from 7 a.m. till 9 p.m. practically every single trading day. And if I wasn't doing that, then I would be giving talks about trading. And then something happened during the crisis in 2009. I was made redundant. Incidentally, I was made redundant on the very day that the market bottomed out. I can't help but find that somewhat ironic. And I started trading for myself. I had a choice between going in and working for another brokerage in this capacity that I had at City Index. But I thought, no, that the time had come that I had learned enough and I had saved up enough money to be self-financed so that I could make the same kind of money that I did when I was working for City Index, which was a good salary. And as the weeks rolled by from my redundancy and I started trading for myself, I noticed very quickly that the patterns that I displayed before I started working for the brokerage 10 years earlier slowly but gradually came back into my trading. So this tapestry of that makes up a trader, I thought that I was well beyond that because I had spent 10 years in a professional capacity. But as I no longer had a paycheck to rely on, I began to find myself in the same kind of emotional state that I had before I joined a professional capacity in the city. And let's just be honest here. I only joined a brokerage because I didn't cut it as a trader initially. I was hopelessly underfunded, hopelessly inexperienced. And all I had was a whimper of a hope and a couple of technical analysis books behind me. And I thought, well, you know, the Holy Grail is, you know, I'll take it from there. And I didn't. And I lost my funding within 18 months. I had worked at a career job in JP Morgan Chase. I had nothing to do with trading, although I sat next to a Bloomberg terminal, which was quite influential in my foray into technical analysis, because the Bloomberg terminal, that's like Mecca, isn't it? It has everything. And so I thought, this is not a good pattern. And here I'm talking about the behavioral pattern. This is not good that I, so soon after having left a professional job where I've spent all day, and I've basically done something that very few people that we call retail traders are able to do, which is to spend practically every single waking moment during the work days observing the markets and get paid for it. And yet somehow I was not able to reproduce the expectations that I had, because I traded well when I worked for City Index, but I didn't really give any thought to why did I trade well and why didn't I trade so well once the security blanket of a monthly paycheck was taken away from me. And so I took some time out, and I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read the chapter I sent you called The Story Behind Best Loser Wins. It's one of my regrets with the book, guys, because it actually tells the story how Best Loser Wins came about. And it's somewhat of a spiritual journey without being religious in that context. But I went on a walk up in the mountains in Spain. It's this journey that some people will call the pilgrim route, where you walk from to Santiago de Compostela. And I happened to, just by pure serendipity, I happened to bump into a Hollywood executive producer that had happened to be a Navy SEAL. And to me, that was nothing short of a revelation, because over the following couple of weeks, him and I, we were walking together, and at nighttime, he had brought a collection of some of the movies that he had produced in Hollywood. And what was so interesting was that two of those movies were particularly enlightening. One was called The Dark Knight Rises, with Liam Neeson and Christian Bale. And there's this particular fighting scene where they're on a frozen lake. And we were talking about the movie and the scene in the movie where the will to act is everything. And it sort of resonated with me, because I felt that we, as traders, home traders, professional traders, we will accumulate an enormous amount of knowledge, an enormous amount of technical knowledge, technical prowess. But if we are not able to execute on that knowledge, then that knowledge, for all intents and purposes, becomes worthless. And then there was another scene, which was somewhat more lighthearted genre, which is the Ocean 11. And there's this scene right in the beginning the movie where George Clooney and Brad Pitt have a conversation about why should we rob the Bellagio Hotel. And essentially because the house always wins. If you always bet the same stake size and you never alter your bet, then the house will always win until if that right hand comes along and you bet big, then you will take the house. Now, my argument here is that that opportunity might not only come once or twice in a lifetime for a professional gambler, but for a professional trader, we have excellent opportunities every single day. What stands between us and the opportunities is our will to act and our patience to wait for that right opportunity. And so this Navy SEAL / Hollywood producer, he was instrumental in me beginning a different kind of journey in trading, which wasn't so focused on technical analysis, because by then I had written every single technical analysis book that I could possibly get my hands on. I was practically subscribing to Harriman House's every single publication as they came out. And it was disappointing for me to know how much I knew, but I was not able to bridge the gap between what I knew and what I wanted to achieve. And that led me to a very different journey. And that journey was a sort of essentially a visualization and meditation journey where I spent an extraordinary amount of time imagining what I wanted to achieve. But I still trained. It wasn't like, oh, I'm not going to do technical analysis now. I'm just going to do visualization, or I'm just going to do technical analysis. I'm not going to do any mental framework. It was more a question of, I began to realize the importance of not just acquiring more and more technical analysis, but in reality begin to look very, very deeply into what is it that makes you take the trades that you do and why. And so we'll then cut to a somewhat later on. I would then receive a phone call from a gentleman that I had worked with at City Index called Andrew Edwards. And Andrew was now the CEO of a brokerage called ETX Capital, which is, I think today is now called OvalX. And he asked me if I was interested in doing some training for their clients in-house. And I said, yeah, sure. So I went to London and I did a talk for the ETX clients and it went down very well. And so he contacted me again, said the feedback has been tremendous. It was much appreciated. It just so happens that we have opened a branch of ETX Capital in Denmark, which is, you know, your home country. Would you like to support their endeavors and maybe be their in-house trainer? And I thought, well, you know what? There's one thing about trading that when you skip all the things aside and you begin to actually dig underneath the surface, it's a rather lonely profession. It isn't this glamorous profession where, you know, you see these YouTube videos of these charlatan sitting on a beach with a laptop. First of all, you can't see anything on a laptop screen anyway on a beach because the sun will be glaring. And secondly, where's my third and my fourth and my fifth screen? I need them. I need to have the big picture view. So I did some training for these ETX Capital clients in Denmark. And then it so happened that I was invited for a Christmas dinner a few years later. I think it was about 18 months later. And I was invited into Andrew Edwards' office, and he looked on the wall, and there were some charts up there, and there was one particular chart that looked very different from all the other charts. It was essentially a P&L curve, and he said, you know what that chart is? That's the P&L curve of the Danish client. And you see all the other charts, which were basically just pointing the other way or flatlining? Those are the profiles of all the other traders we have globally, and we have been racking our brains why the Danish profile client is so vastly different to what all the other profile of clients that we have from anywhere else in the world, including even Scandinavian countries. And we came up that they have exactly the access to the same data, same charts, same news flow, same web seminar, you know, that they offered in English. But what they don't have is someone coming to Denmark or their respective countries and traveling around Denmark and giving talks about technical analysis / trading psychology. And he said, I don't know what you're doing, but you are extending the lifetime of the clients and they are significantly more profitable than all our other clients. And I urge you to write a book about what it is that you're doing. And, you know, so here we are, and that conversation took place in 2012, 13. So here we are knocking on 2023. So it's taken me a good 10 years. But you know what? I'm not really an author either. And I remember the famous Mark Douglas, who's no longer with us, sadly. He said he expected to write that book, Trading in the Zone, in about 6 months' time, and it took him 8 years. And I kind of relate to that because every single time I thought, all right, this is it, then someone would ask me something, and I'll go, damn, I haven't thought about that. Oh, I need to rewrite this. And so Harriman House, God bless them, that has got to be, they have the patience of saints and angels in that publisher, because the amount of rewrites that I did and the amount of edits and, oh, I don't quite like it. The latest one being that I actually, the official publication date was September 2020. And then we waited 2 years because I wasn't quite happy with the final script. I'm just going to say it out here out loud. Had it not been for them, this book would never have been materialized, because it would have been one of those fantasy stories that we watched 20, 30 years ago called The Never Ending Story. So that's kind of where we are. And so I'm sorry, I'm talking 100 miles an hour. I'm sorry about that. But you asked me a specific question. Where were you? Where are you? And where do you want to be? I want to trade bigger, Mark. You asked the question. I think it's this... It's almost like this Kobe Bryant Mamba mentality. I'm not doing this to prove it to anybody else. I'm doing it to prove to how good can I become? How big can I actually turn this? So sometimes people ask me, well, why don't you open a fund? I'm thinking, maybe that kind of, you know, I'm also, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and I think that boat has probably sailed. And I like my family time, and I like my private time, and I like that I can, I've just, for example, this year, I managed to lose £150,000 in 2 days about 4 weeks ago. And I thought, not good. I had a pretty good year. But to blow that much money so quickly, I thought, I need a holiday. And so I just left everything for a month. And incidentally, I walked in the mountains again, which seemed to be my spiritual arena, just to reset everything. So, Mike, that's where I want to be. It's this forever exploit of how big can you become, Mark? How good can you become? And it's not about more technical analysis. I don't need more indicators, moving averages, combinations, stochastics, and and I know this is sponsored by the Society of Technical Analysts, and we need them. But we also need a realization that by itself is not enough. Because if it was enough, then we wouldn't have a losing ratio. When you look at brokers, that's one of the things that the ESMA regulation 2018 brought to light was, wow, a lot of people are actually losing money, even though they are relatively well-financed, even though they have access to all the latest charts, all the latest AE, and so forth. It's not enough. That's why I wrote the book. I was not going to write a book about technical analysis. We have enough of them.
Wow, thank you, Tom. And you know what? So much of that is resonating with me because, just before we started this podcast, I'm actually writing my book for Harriman House. So you probably liaised with Craig, I'm guessing.
Yes. Here's to you, Craig. You have pictures of a
saint. I first met Craig, I think, in 2018 or maybe 2017. And he said, you know, we're looking for more books. You know, we've done a great book with Steve Ward, who, you know, he's been our guest a couple of times, and Steve's great. And, you know, it sold really well. That was high performance trading. And, you know, we want a few more like that. You know, we don't want an exact copy, but, you know, could you come up with something?
And I said, and yes, have you?
I'm sure I could. Well,
it's not 5 years. No.
I took 4 years coming up with an idea, and I finally got it to one that we agreed on at the beginning of this year. So I've been writing the book now for a few months.
Well, you let the cat out of the bag now. Can you tell us what it is? I know that we've just turned the tables here and now I'm interviewing you, but I'm curious.
Well, I haven't actually got a title yet, and I don't know if you would relate to that, because I've changed the title so many times. But it's really, at the core of it, it's about the battle every trader faces with themselves. And in your book, you you have a section called Fighting My Humanness. And you could say that is the book. But it's more than that. It's about, you know, it's what is trading. Like you've come up with so many things there that people think that trading is just learning technical analysis, for example. So an example I use often is card counting. You know, anyone can learn to card count. Very few people, and I'm talking about blackjack here, of course, very few people can make card counting work for them. You know, there's lots of aspects to it. Of course, part of it is not getting caught. You know, it's an incredibly difficult skill. And yet it's so incredibly simple at the same time. You know, the rules of card counting are simple. You could learn the basics of it in a day. You probably would never make it work. You know, very few people. It's a very skilled activity to be able to do it without anyone noticing. The casinos are always playing anti-card counting routines. You know, they're talking away, trying to knock you out your stride. There are people that do it. Serve you alcohol, of course. You know, they want you in at the end of the day, you know, when you're at your most tired. So it's incredibly difficult to do. They'll redeal the shuffle, the pack regularly. Their whole setup is guided because that's really possibly the only true way to get an edge in a casino. There's lots of ways you can get micro edges in blackjack. And there are things you can do, which, again, very skilled players do it and they do win. But really, you know, and it's often, I think, people bring a combination of these together. And it's just, I think it's the same.
It does bring up a very interesting question, Steve, because you go to the casino, but do you go to the casino to gamble or do you go to the casino to have a good time with your friends? Is there an element of a social engagement in the casino experience?
There's three elements. There's the people who go for entertainment. So the gamblers, the chancers, they'll take their luck. There's the people who think they can win, but they can't. They're trying to play a game. They think they've got an edge, but they don't. And that is, I think, that 99% of traders, you know. And then there's the people who really do know how to make the edge work for themselves, who've managed to find the edge. And they normally have taken years of practice and, you know, you know, they need to be resourced. You know, I think all these things that you mentioned on your journey to becoming, you know, a successful trader. And you know, there's this thing that even if you've got the card count totally on your side and the edge totally your favor, you still could lose a lot of money because it comes down to randomness at the end of the day.
Yes, it does.
And so you have to manage your pot. You know, you can't just, but you also have to go aggressive at the right time. You know, you play small and then you go aggressive when you've got an edge with no guarantee that edge is going to work.
That's right. So the title that you're looking for, the title that I eventually came up with, was actually stolen a bit.
The Phantom of the Pits.
Yeah, it was. I read Phantom of the Pits. Now, they verbalized it slightly differently, but I thought, best loser wins. And I was discussing with a friend of mine, he goes, that's a catchy title. And no disrespect to Harriman House, but they had this idea of a book title called, you know, the Exploits of a Trader, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted something that was a little bit different, something that would go, okay, that's a bit like, the, you know, that chicken soup for the soul or who ate my cheese kind of things. Like, what the hell are they talking about? Is it a cheese book or is it a chicken soup book? I wanted something that, you know, I wanted to actually hammer home the idea that I didn't become a good trader until I learned to lose. And incidentally, much of what I'm saying in the book is also flat out stolen from people before me. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants like Marty Swart and Charlie DeFrancesca, Charlie D. And they were essentially verbalizing the same thing as well. When you look at Pit Trader, no, what's it called? Marty Swartz, is it called Pit Trader? I think it's called Pitbull. Pitbull, sorry. In one of the pages, he says, I didn't learn to make money until I learned to lose. And then Charlie D, he was saying, you got to fight your humanness. Your humanness will be to let the loss run because at that point in time, the way that we managed to evolve where we are today was through through being able to run when we needed to run and run like hell and then fight when we needed to fight. And I think it's interesting when you look at our journey, our DNA journey for the last 100,000 years. We might be living in a modern society today, and we don't have much reason to run from anything. But the reality is that when we are faced with adversity, particularly in the financial markets, and particularly in short-term trading, our old behavioral traits will surface. So we will not take our loss, because one of the things that will spring up emotionally first is hope. And so I call that the supermarket mentality. When we go to the supermarket on a Saturday morning and we are surfing around the aisles for, you know, what we need and also for good offers, we're seeing, well, hang on, this toilet paper here is on sale for, you know, 50% off. So I better get some toilet paper in. But when we are faced in the market, and it really came to mind during the first year and the last years of my experience at the brokerage City Index, because in the first year we were in a bear market. And I think I described that in the book. Well, I know I did, that I had this social engagement where the best clients of, it was called Financial Spreads, were taking out to Cheltenham for the race course. And as we sat there and the executive coach, I was introduced by the CEO, Stuart Lane, and he said, hey, this is our financial technical analysis wizard. You can ask him anything. It's like, well, that's being thrown out in the deep end. And of course, people, they don't want to hear about anything but their own particular investments. And one of the stocks that they were all piling into was a stock called, and I'm sure you guys will remember it as well, it's a stock called Marconi. And Marconi at the time had had a absolute stellar run and had peaked out around, I think it was about 1,200. I might get it wrong, but at that point where this social engagement had taken place, Marconi had fallen about more than 50-odd%. And the question was straight out of a textbook. Do you think that Marconi is a good buy here? Do you think that it is cheap? And in the book, I make this argument that when I'm sitting day trading, and the same when investing, I prefer to buy something that has already risen, or I prefer to sell short something that has already significantly fallen. But the whole supermarket mentality that I saw play itself out in the 10 years that I was on a trading floor was that if the Dow Jones was on a tear during an afternoon, you could be sure shit that clients wouldn't be looking to buy. They wouldn't be looking to join the momentum. They would be looking to fighting the momentum. And that was puzzling for us, sitting on a trading desk, seeing the markets rising. Back then, it wasn't as dramatic as it is today. But if the Dow had a 70-point rally in an afternoon, you think, wow, that's a big rally. And yet our clients, they wouldn't be looking to join that. Instead, they would be looking to selling short. And I did a lot of introspection in why are they doing that? What is it emotionally that is happening to us? What is it that's chemically happening in our minds that we don't perceive it as an opportunity? We perceive it as a threat. And the problem is that we will be successful just often enough when we fight a bull trend or we dive into a bear trend and buy instead. We will be successful just often enough for our minds to remember, oh, I remember that time when you did buy the low and it was actually the low and then it rallied. It may happen again. The problem that I saw was that clients were losing over and over because they simply didn't have the fortitude or what I call the mental preparation to, shall we say, combat the natural responses, the natural chemical responses that are happening from epinephrine, dopamine, adrenaline. These things are rushing around your brain like a chemical cocktail, and they are affecting the way that you are perceiving the market. So it's a bit like what Annie Nin, the French philosopher, she said, you don't see the world as as it is. You see the world as you are. And so much of my mental preparation is actually getting to the bottom of what is it that I'm seeing and what is it that I'm thinking. And so just as an example here, today, this morning, I was thoroughly tempted to short the FTSE index because there was a double top. And at the same time, I'm thinking, well, it's a very strong momentum bar higher. And when it comes to it, all we can really control as traders is what we think and how much we want to risk. We are not in control of our reward ratios, which is one of the reasons why I argue against the whole risk to reward. I know what my risk is, but I can never know what my reward ratio is. Never, unless I make up a reward ratio for myself. But here's the problem with a reward ratio, at least in my book, is that say that I was shorting the FTSE today, and I was thinking it was about 75-40 or thereabout, 75-35. Well, let's say that I risk 15 points and I had a stop loss at 75-50. Would I then take my profit when it got to 7,500? Because by then I would have made two times my risk. My argument is that the way that I have brainwashed myself is that, no, it's not going to happen, because by the time that we get down to 7,500, I'm going to go, ooh, this is looking weak. And when something is weak, I want to sell more. And that right there is a prime example of how the 1% are thinking versus the 99% thinking, because I assure you that if you were having access to people who also sold short at 75.35 today, they would have taken half profit at 75.20 and maybe another third of their profit at 75.10. But one of the things that truly made a difference in my life, and I'm gonna do a little bit of name dropping here, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention his name, because he had such a significant impact on my trading. And that's a gentleman called Dr. David Paul. And if you ever want a candidate for your Alpha Mind broadcast, you should really interview him. He's a doctor I'm pretty sure it's in mineralogy. He always boasts that, you know, in that movie with Bruce Willis called Armageddon, and they have this particular drill. Well, David Paul always said that he was actually the one that invented that drill. That's the capacity of his brain. Phenomenal. But he once said that you must endeavor to do the opposite of what comes natural to you. And so what comes natural to someone when they're a profitable position is that they want to take their profit or want to take part their profit. And it's one of those axioms that we see swirling around in society, is that, well, you can't go broke taking a profit. Well, actually, you can go broke taking a profit. And so what you really should consider doing is, instead of taking profit, you should go all in and you add to your winning position. So my religion, and I think it's one of the things I probably developed a bit of a name from in the world of trading, is that I will add, and I'll add very aggressive to my trades, that my profitable trades. And I can thank two people for that. One is Dr. David Paul, and the other one is a gentleman who's sadly no longer with us, and that's Charlie D. And it is actually in the book by William Fallon, I think it is, published by Wiley. The legend of Charlie D, there's a transcript of an coaching session that he did at the Chicago Board of Trade in front of all the old and new traders, or the pit traders, which incidentally can still be found on YouTube today. And one of the things that he's talking about is, he says, you know you're a good trader when you add to a winning position. And that to me was, I got to learn how to add to my position. And there's also something very antidotal about doing the opposite of what your chemical composition is urging you to do. Because the thing is that when we are in a winning position, our minds are actually saying, hey, why don't you take some profit? Why is it doing that, ladies and gentlemen? Stephen and Mark, I'm going to ask you a question here, just for kicks, okay? Just because I'm talking 100 miles an hour and just give you an opportunity to comment. Why do you think it is that we get this urge to take part profits when we are sat on a good position?
We'll return to the podcast shortly. The AlphaMind podcast is sponsored by TradeStation Global and the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. TradeStation Global is a multi-asset trading platform with access to international markets where you can trade a range of instruments from one account and leverage professional-grade tools like Radar Screen, The Matrix, and Easy Language. And with TradeStation Global, there are no hidden price spreads, just transparent, low commissions. To find out more and to open an account, visit tradestation-international.com/AlphaMind or go to our website, alpha-mind.net, or see the link in the episode description. The Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, provide world-beating technical analysis education programs and offer outstanding membership services. AlphaMind podcast listeners can obtain a 10% discount on the cost of their excellent home study course and home study course with a diploma package. To find out more about this offer, go to our website, alpha-mind.net, or see the link in the episode description. Now, back to the podcast.
Well, I think there is a tendency to just want to bank. Sometimes there's this... You know, one can bank, reevaluate, and get back in, though. So sometimes it just becomes part of a journey.
Can I pause you there, then, Mark? Why would you bank? What are you telling yourself when you're saying I can always get back in again?
Well, you're kind of not believing in your first position in a way, and what you're saying is that actually you want to be adding to it rather than coming out and resetting. But I think there it depends on what market you're trading, what time of day it is.
Of course.
You know, what's about to come out, whether your information profile has changed on the market. Yeah, I think that there is a temptation, I think, for many to take profit, but it all depends on the timing of the trade and where you are. If you're doing that late on a Friday, then it may well be reasonable to think, actually, I need to sort of reduce risk rather than add when we're coming into maybe the witching hour of the S&Ps or something. And there's an option... Yeah, and there's a massive option sort of settlement coming through. You know, those sorts of things can turn up at the wrong moment during the trajectory of your trade to suddenly make you think, actually, I just need to maybe step back and maybe ahead of data or if new data comes out, black swan events, or, you know, someone coming out with an announcement. I think there are going to be moments when, okay, you need to take something out and then to reevaluate. Once the information has settled down, I like this. I do like your supermarket analogy piece in terms of a natural tendency is to kind of buy something that's got cheap, right? But not to buy something that's getting more expensive. Although I think at the moment, with the way the world's going, we tend to want to go longer toilet rolls because we think they're going to be three times more expensive.
You know what? That's the wisest words I've heard all week.
Yeah, I think the world. I think historically, you're absolutely right that we tend to look for bargains. Suddenly, I want to fill up my tanker £1.80 because I think this is going to £1.90 before I next fill up. Yeah. So I think mentality has changed around that, and I think. That's fine. But I think it's answering your question. It does depend on what time of day it is, you know, what time in the sequence is. I think in reality, believing in yourself to want to add to your belief is fine. But there's a big caveat to that.
You're obviously exponentially increasing your risk. And some of the greatest damages I've done to my account is if I've been overly aggressive to the downside or to the upside. And I run a Telegram channel and people there, for better or worse, can witness when it goes well, but they can certainly also witness when it blows up in my face. Mm-hmm. And what I often do when I have one of those blows up in your face is I need to remove myself from the situation for, you know, it could be 5 minutes, it could be for an hour. And what I actually do in that time is I attempt to wash my physical body, clean of whatever chemicals are floating around that wants revenge, that wants to get back in, wants to get emotionally, get back to equilibrium. And this is the argument that I am trying to make in the book, is that we need to become much more mindful of what it is that we are thinking when we have been subjected to losses and when we have been subjected to winners. Incidentally, I have a little anecdote that I thought I'd share with you. A friend of mine came to me and wanted to have some mentoring. And I'm not in the business of doing mentoring, but I do like to talk shop and I do like to talk about trading. And he gave me access to his trading account, and I downloaded it, and I basically just put it into an Excel spreadsheet, and I drew some columns. And he said, and I said to him, this has got to be the easiest fix ever. Whenever you have a big winning day, you always lose the day after. You're a brilliant trader, but something happens to you the day after a big win that you somehow you are chemically out of balance, whether it's because you're exuberant, because you're overly confident. And I urge you to actually, if you have a big win, don't trade the following day. Just see how that goes. Now, I don't know whether he did it, but he reported back. You know, that's the thing between, you know, anecdotal evidence and actually empirical evidence. But this anecdotal evidence would suggest that if he didn't trade the day after a big win, he would actually keep his money. And my argument would be that he would actually give his body a 24-hour cycle to just calm down again. And, you know, let the adrenaline subside. If you've ever been in a fight in your life or if you like to put on the boxing gloves, you also know that even though you're getting a good smack or two, you don't want to get in there because the adrenaline is pumping around your body. And that's the whole design of the body. It is designed from a prehistoric time when we were faced with predators that were basically our apex predators. And so that we needed to either we fight or we die.
And yeah, absolutely. I mean, and to add to that, I think that the state of that, and I've seen it, is it's fight, flight, freeze, or faint. Okay, in terms of what that reaction could be. In trading rooms, I've seen all of those. I've seen people freeze that literally are in a state that they just can't move, and one had to be wheeled out in a wheelchair. And so it is super toxic by not managing yourself and dealing with the letting go. I mean, I think letting go is sort of what we're on about here, particularly around one talks about the letting go of the pain and trauma of losses. But of course, I think it's also super important to let go of the euphoria of a significant win, because it just creates you into this different state that then is not optimal to go out there and be aware to just see what the next opportunity was. And just going back to your books, I know we sort of, yeah, we've got to remember that, you know, the book is sort of, you know, why we got you on. But there is a lovely, lovely story of you being at dinner with Luke Donald. And you were asking Luke Donald about Tiger, right?
Yes.
Just share that story, because that makes a lot of sense to me. And there's a lot of people in this space that play golf as well as trade. So
Okay. Well, I'll readily say to everyone, I know nothing about golf apart from, you know, what an eagle is and what a birdie is and a hole in one, and I know who Tiger Woods is. But I happened to be going to the Wimbledon final in 2007, and I was invited to Ralph Lauren's tent. And I think it was because I was appearing on CNBC to do interviews, and someone at the CNBC office had taken pity on me because I didn't go there for my dress sense, that's for sure. And so there I was in Ralph Lauren's tent, and I happened to sit next to Luke Donald, who at the time was number 9 on the world golfing ranking list. And when you're in a tent like that, you do get a bit to drink. I mean, they do like to look after you. And so there's lots of PIMS and whatever else you want when you are at a Ralph Lauren tent. And so maybe I would be asking some questions that I wouldn't normally have had if I hadn't been a little bit intoxicated. So I basically turned to Luke Donald and I said, "So, Luke, why are you number 9 and not number 1? Why is Tiger Woods so much better than you?" Now, I know it's a bit of a flippant question to ask, but he took it in the most beautiful way that you could possibly, as I could possibly imagine, and hence this anecdote, it can now be told in book and here. He said, "I don't think that Tiger Woods physically is better than I am. I think that I can shoot it just as straight as he can, maybe even straighter, maybe even longer, because I am stronger than him. But where Tiger Woods separates himself from the entire crowd of all the other golf players on tour is that he has an almost inhuman goldfish mentality." So, and then he described it through an example that if I had done a double bogey on the 15th and Tiger Woods had done a double bogey on the 15th, which I'm led to believe that, you know, you're meant to par, it's not good. That's what golfers will know what I'm talking about. And non-golfers know bogeying is not good. By the time you got over to tee up at the 16th hole, it was as if Tiger Woods had forgotten all about what happened moments before, while I was still swirling around in this cocktail of misery and disappointed in myself that it would affect my tee up and my shot on the 16th. So Tiger Woods could basically be putting for the Augusta Championship, and he needed to make the putt, and it was like a 20-foot putt, and he would be cool as a cucumber, wouldn't affect him. It was as if it was just another day training on the green. That's the difference between Tiger Woods and I. And I thought it was such a beautiful story because it was set with such sincerity. He's a very sincere man. He's very humble, very down to earth. And, you know, you can't help but take an instant liking to him. And then when he came up with something so profound, I thought, this has got to go into a book somewhere so that people can read this. Because I also think that it also highlights the margins between number one and number nine. And I have led to believe that Tiger Woods was thoroughly schooled through his father, who was a Green Beret, in the minds of performing. Incidentally, you both mentioned Steve Ward, and I happened to witness Steve Ward on a stage back in April when he gave a talk in London. And he came aboard, and you know, Steve is a big guy, like very imposing, and he stands there and he's towering all over all of us. And he's saying to us, there's a crowd of a couple of hundred people, and he says to us, "Hey, trading psychology, how important do you think it is in your overall trading arsenal, in your trading preparation? And I'd like you to give a percentage on it." And I was like, someone raised, "I think it's 40%. And I think it's 50%. And then someone said, "I think it's 70%. I think it's..." And then so we sort of settled on the fact that trading psychology, or how we think when we're trading, probably accounts for about 80-85%, which seems to be the general consensus amongst these couple of hundred people. And then he sprung the proverbial bomb on us. And he said, "If you think that successful trading is 80-odd% mind, why do you spend 99% on technical analysis and probably no percent at all on mental preparation?" And Steve, Mark, it was like a religious experience where the Holy Spirit just swooshes through the auditorium, and there was this silence and people going, yeah, never really thought about that. I'm saying that it's 80%, that trading is more mind-related, but I spent zero time on actually preparing my mind. And it was just so beautiful the way that he was able to lead us down to a trap. And then he sprung the trap on us. Well, not me personally, because at that point I'd already written the book. But, you know, I played along and I go, "Oh, yeah, yeah."
See, I would go 100. And the reason I say that...
Yeah, 80 is cheap.
It's like what percentage of baking a cake is the heat? Well, if you don't put it in the oven and turn the heat on, you don't get a cake. It's 100%. You know, you can't define it, in other words, but it is so crucial.
Here comes the most important question then, Steve, is that we can talk about it. We can skirt around the issue here. But how do you actually mentally prepare yourself? How do you actually become a better trader through mental preparation? And that's why I wrote the book. I didn't want to just discuss it. I didn't want to just talk about it. Oh, yeah, you got to do your mental preparation. No, I have described some exercises that I go through every single day. I mean, even something like just before I came on board here, you know, every single day I sit and I train my mind, not only on patterns, but also through visualization, through meditation. And I know it sounds a bit 60s hippie, you know, with long hair. Well, not me, but long hair and hippie in mind. But actually, there was a movie that I saw recently called Rush, and it describes this symbiotic relationship between Niki Lauda and James Hunt, a British racing driver. And there's this scene where James Hunt is actually lying on a floor in a big mansion with his eyes closed, and he's driving the race course in his mind's eye. He's going through all the corners, all the straights, all the curves, everything that he needs to be mindful of on the next day's race. And then the the hot lady comes into the room and interrupts him. And he says, I'm basically just mentally preparing myself. And I find it so important that when I sit down to trade, that I would have spent as much time on my mental preparation than I have on, you know, in fact, I'll say this to you. If I had the choice between an hour's preparation on charts, on hour preparations, on mental preparation, I'll always choose the mental preparation, because the charts, you know, the charts are the charts, you know, double bottom, double top, extended candle, la-di-da-da-da, that rarely changes. It is how I will react when it happens. And more importantly, when I will have my losers, and, you know, I think I lose on approximately 45% on all my trades. I cannot afford to let one of those trades run out of control. And that I need to mentally prepare my mind for, because otherwise, if I don't tame that mind, he is going to let that run. Why? Well, because, hey, it might turn around. And my mind is always hopeful at the wrong time, and it's always fearful at the wrong time. When I have a good profit, my mind's going to go, oh, you better take it. You better take it, because it might disappear. That's fear talking. It's not hope. It's fear talking. And, oh, you're on a losing position here, but let's give it another 5-minute bar. Let's give it another 10 minutes. Let's move that stop loss down, because, hey, it might turn around.
Yeah, no, I think part of my background is I actually bespokely build visualization and meditation journeys for traders as part of my coaching, and I'm on the regulatory body of mindfulness in the UK as a board member. And it is a hugely powerful, you know, part of decision-making, part of the management of self, and all the other stuff that comes with it, not just decision making, but the pure awareness that's required in such a complex environment as trading is critical. And one of our guests on the podcast was an ex-Navy SEAL commander that now runs Men Talking Mindfulness in the States, John McCaskill. And he was just saying that, you know, it's not just about self, it's understanding that without it, you create a weapon that faces you, and you're constantly fighting this weapon that's self-created. And by going into this better state of being and self-regulation, you have a better appreciation of where your assets are, as he was talking, like, from a point of view of warfare, but also a more of a compassion for the enemy too. So, you know, and you can fit that to the market, that the market almost becomes your enemy, and you kind of have to have some respect for it. Otherwise, it will grab you, shake you, and tip you over into this, like you say, this
chew you up and spit you out.
Exactly. I also want, I think, whilst you talked about Stevie Ward, who's a great friend of ours, he does have the Trader Mind Journal, okay?
He gave me a copy. It's amazing.
Yeah, which is a very good piece, but I know that you in your book talk about journaling to determine truths and confront flaws, and you use it as a pre-trade warm-up to go back through narrative of whatever the time span you want to look at, right? But yeah, to almost tune you to the day. And I think that was a good link to Steve, but I think that's a good part of the book to talk about, because I think a lot of people out there in retail trading land probably don't journal, but you see it as an art, but also a key part of your decision making.
Yeah, so I want to be very specific here. I don't journal I don't sit and write, dear diary, today I lost a lot of money. It's not dear diary time. It is for all intents and purposes, let's talk practical nuts and bolts here. I've created a PowerPoint presentation, and I call that my book of truth, or sometimes the book of horror, depending on what mood I'm in. And part of my preparation will go in, and I'll select a handful of days, and I'll go through these days. So, and these are trades that I have taken. And the reason why I'm doing that, and I tend to focus a lot on my losing trades, because I seem to be very good at just letting winners run and add aggressively to them. But where I need to be incredibly mindful is to never add to a losing trade ever. And I'm going to say I'm going to do that on one trade out of 100. And even so, there's some circumstances where I will add to a losing trade, and it's not what you think. It's strictly under control. But two, perhaps more importantly, is that when I have a losing trade, I need to physically feel the loss. And I am rekindled with the loss when I see the loss on my PowerPoint. And my
my mind cannot differentiate between this being something that has happened in the past or is happening right here, right now. It's one of the reasons why we watch horror movies, because we think we're actually in this horror movie. We get that excitement. We don't just passively watch. Don't look behind the door. He's behind the door with the axe. That kind of sensation. So part of my preparation for my trading day and any given trading day is that I physically have to be confronted with the fear, and so that I instantly can tune my mind into do what you need to do and do not be subjective. Do not get drawn into the emotions that you feel. Be very, very ice cool about it. And I believe that my trading performance reflects that I am ice cold to take losses. I just take them and I move on. But I think one of my greatest traits as a trader is that I can have a trade and the market will move against me, and I'll close it and I will flip my position and I'll go in the opposite direction. Not many traders can do that and do it controlled, so you're not just recklessly gambling away. And that came from that constant exposure to losing trade and managing the emotions that you feel. So I could be every single day, business basically just a printout of it, but I'll be sitting going, okay, I bought there and the market tanked, and I feel that pain that my mind will send to me, and I'll deal with it and I'll confront it and I say, okay, do what you need to do. And through that process, Mark, I am essentially desensitizing my mind to losses to the point where I am no longer incapacitated to act according to the process that I want to do. For me, successful trading is all about being process orientated, not goal orientated. I don't go into 2022 thinking, oh, I hope I'm going to make £1 million this year, and then if I make £1 million, I'll stop. No, I'm at 1.5 million pounds right now. But then I put 100,000 back to the market. I'm thinking, I need a break right now. So I have come to that point where I have desensitized myself to completely feel anything. However, and this is an important point, I feel that this book was warranted, because this is not a one-off exercise. Any more than going to the gym once a week is a one-off exercise. I believe that our bodies and our minds are related in what we call entropy. If that we don't constantly flex that muscle, the muscle will become weak. That's why I do the preparation every single day.
Yeah, if we don't use it, we lose it, right? So there you go.
Yeah, that's right.
Fascinating, really. I think you talked about James Hunt. James Hunt used to live about 500 meters away where I am now.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, it's an interesting world.
He was an interesting character, wasn't he?
Oh, my God, yeah. I don't know how many cigarettes he smoked in his life, but he was certainly, he had a good life, I think.
He reminded me a little bit of George Best. Tons and tons of ability, tons and tons of talent that they also cultivated, but then they also became their own worst enemy.
Yeah, I think George Best lived about 3 miles from here, so they
maybe it's the area you're living in.
Yeah, I need to watch myself. But there's another quote from your book I love, which is climbing the wall of worry and sliding down the slope of hope.
Yeah. That one I made up myself.
I like that.
Which you could probably tell that I'm not English.
In this encyclopedia of a book, I hadn't seen it elsewhere. But I thought that is it. That's kind of what it feels like for many people.
Yeah. And so what I'm hoping here, and I'm not saying that because of the enormously small royalties that I receive from Harriman House, and that's not a dig. You don't become rich from writing a book. But I'm hoping that people would...
5 more years of this.
But I'm hoping that people would engage with the book, because I believe that what started off as an experiment with ETX Capital clients 10 years ago, that when a CEO notices the performance in a segment of their client population is vastly different from everybody else, and then he encouraged you to write about it, I believe that he said that because generally he could see that the Danish traders that I had taught simply performed better. They were much more fluid in the market than the general trading population is.
that's what I'm hoping that people will come to realize, that actually that there's much more to be said about trading than just boiling it down to moving averages and, yeah, and technical indicators.
If you read the book in early stages, you almost sense there's this fight between your view on technical analysis. It's almost like, don't do it at some point when I was reading the book. But actually, when you get clearer, because actually you still use charts at a very simple vanilla level from what I can see. And there's nothing wrong with that, because one of the biggest ever Brent traders who traded about 30% of the world's Brent I knew, he just kept it very, very simple and made an awful lot of money. And there is a tendency for people that are getting involved in technical, because to have every bloody indicator up and running, right? So, and that's a mistake, quite frankly, to have so much saturation. Very, very interesting. I think the journey of the book is really good, and I think it's great how you weave it as this evolving story. No doubt you're linking to other bits of work too, but I think it's good that you brought it all together in a way that people can pick up, and come out of that with, someone with 40 years market experience like me has come out with, at least five stick-its in there thinking, that's a pretty smart thing.
Thank you.
That's a pretty smart thing to say. And I'm sure Steve has too. So I think from an industry point of view, I think we're grateful for someone putting the work in, because it is hard work, right, to get this stuff together. And I guess love the little funny stories. But do you think you've found your purpose yet? Quiet moment there from Tom.
Yeah. No, but say the market's closed. Now, let me give you a different story. I've just had a holiday, and I had to force myself not to open my phone just to get that little fix. And when it became too much, I dug into my backpack, and I had five random charts that I just grabbed, and I just felt I got this sensation of a fix, like a drug addict. I thought, oh, okay, there's a few charts. So, yeah, I think I found my purpose. And I think the purpose is not only my vocation, but also passing on the knowledge. Look, Harriman House, for all I care, could give my royalties to charity. I am certainly not doing for that. I'm doing it because I have a desire to help others achieve what I have achieved. And I know it's doable. I absolutely know it's doable because, I wasn't first in the queue when they handed out brains, and I wasn't a first class honor student from Oxford University. But what I did do was I never gave up. I'm a fighter, and sort of brought up from the street. What is my ex-wife? She used to say, "You weren't brought up; you were dragged up." And I think there's this street fighting mentality. You're not going to get the better of me. And I think many people actually have that. But the problem here is that they think that more of the same is what's needed. They think, oh, I'm not very good. I'm not a good trader. I need more technical analysis. And I also think that the mindfulness is met by a segment of the population going, that's a bit airy-fairy. It's a bit whimsical. It's a bit gayish. It's a bit – nothing could be further from the truth. It's actually an exploration into your own inner workings that makes you – what makes you do what you do. When you do it,
it's an incredible thing. You're quite right. I mean, there's stigma around yoga, there's stigma around mental health, and there's stigma around one of the most efficient solutions, which is mindfulness. So I was in a big corporate this week, and we had to call something aligned to it called MindFit, just to get better acceptability. The wrapper is very, very important. The content doesn't change, but
I'm laughing because I can see what Steve is doing.
What is he doing?
I have no idea. Dear viewer, over the last 1 minute, I have watched Steve dissemble the microphone.
it's cool. It's fallen to pieces.
It broke. The hinge bracket in my mouth.
This is the worst podcast I've ever been in.
He's lost it because he's now worrying about the next 5 years of writing this book.
I mean, honestly, this is fantastic hearing it because... You know, there's part of me thinking, damn, he's written the same book as me. I'm going to have to tear this up. from this, what you talked about, how we struggle with our natural self, I call it our default human operating system, is not made for trading. It's completely not. It is the worst. We are just not made this way. We are not wired for trading, but it doesn't mean we can't. It doesn't mean we can't achieve, because somebody has to. You only have to come in the top group. And one trade is not a trader. One trade, one great trade doesn't make you a trader. You told a story in there, which I loved, and it was near the beginning of the book. And it was about someone who, he put on this fantastic trade. It was the one where the French franc was overvalued.
Yeah.
He'd been trying to buy a hot dog in France.
It was a hot dog stand story in Paris, and he's thinking, how expensive is this hot dog?
Yeah. And he came back and he said, right, French franc is drastically, you know, he didn't just look at that. He looked at all prices.
Yeah.
And then he's like, this is just not sustainable. And you said he made a fortune on that trade, and yet he lost all his money.
So it's, to put that story into context, it was a story that I was told by my boss, Stuart Lane, when I worked at Financial Spreads. And he was very fond of telling the story down in the pub after work. And the story basically goes that this gentleman, who of course shall be remain nameless, he had been to France, and for whatever reason, he wasn't part of the journey up to the Eiffel Tower with the family, and he decided to have a hot dog. And so the guy at the hot dog stand sells him this hot dog and says, 100 franc, or maybe not, but very, very expensive. And he said, how much? I said, well, you know, and so he thought, well, I think he's just taking advantage of me because I'm British. So I walked around the corner and ordered a different hot dog, but they also charged this extraordinary amount of money for a hot dog. So I decided to go into a supermarket, and I just picked up some basic groceries like eggs, milk, bread, butter, you name it. And the cost of it in franc compared to pounds was extraordinary. So when I came home, and this is obviously, he was a client of Financial Spread and Stuart Lane, he basically started shorting the French franc. And I think he also shorted some other currencies. And what you have to remember, what makes this story so remarkable is, you know, in the day that we trade in now, the bid-ask spread in, say, Eurodollar is 0.6, 0.8, or 0.4, depending on who we're trading with. Back then, you probably paid 10 pips wide for Eurodollar. Not that I even think Eurodollar existed at that point, and because you had the French franc, but, you know, other currencies, very wide spread. And I think I was told that he traded on a 30-pip wide spread. And he kept adding and adding and adding to his trade. And yes, he made more than £5 million. And this is in 1996 money, not 2022 money. Not that I'm sure that's any difference now that I think about it. But nevertheless, that's a hell of a lot of money. And then almost like and then there's this silence in the story. He says, and then he blew it all. Every single penny. And I remember that story when I wrote the book, because I thought to myself, it's important that people also understand that when you make a lot of money trading, you are also at your most vulnerable. You can never let up. You are never out of the fight. Never, ever, ever. It's like there's this quote from a lone survivor, Marcus Luttrell. He's up in the mountains with Mike Murphy, and they're fighting the Taliban. And Mike Murphy is about to do the ultimate sacrifice, which is to go and make a phone call on the ridge, but he will surely die. He will be shot. And he just turns to Marcus Luttrell, who's played by Mark Wahlberg, and he says, Marcus, you are never out of the fight. And I know that when I trade at my best, it is with an intensity that comes with my vocation. And I also know that I've become slack if I'm going, what's for dinner? You know, that's when I lose. And that's why I trade with the intensity that I do. And that is perpetuated by my adding aggressively to my trade, because I know that when I am at my best, I add aggressively and I am not worried about that the market's going to turn around. If it turns around, then I'll take some losses. But I also have these tremendous days where I ride a trend throughout the day, basically what I call a trend day. And you only need one of those trend days a month to make an astounding difference. But the key here is, do you have the balls to actually ride that trend? And I'm saying it's not just about taking a loss. It's also keeping your pause when you have a big profit. And you know what? That's probably even more difficult for people than it is taking a loss. Would you believe it?
That's why the example you give in this story is great.
You say that the number of traders that are truly great are incredibly rare. See, for me, you get people who do one good trade or jump on a bull move or a trend and think they are great. And the only person fooled, unfortunately, is them. And, you know, they're fooled into thinking they're good. But trading is a performance activity. You know, someone new to golf can go on a golf course today or tomorrow and hit a hole in one. That does not mean they are ready to play on the PGA. Golf is a performance activity. And you have to become repeatedly good again and again in multiple environments over many years. It requires developing the skills and abilities to become good. And it's the same for trading. Becoming a good trader takes a hell of a long time. And people often confuse, you know, for example, they often confuse learning a system with becoming a trader. You can become very good at applying a system, but systems usually have a sell-by date or the market environment changes and that system is no longer applicable. And then people find out that, hell, I'm suddenly no good. No, you usually were never that good to start with, because becoming good takes years. And to succeed at trading, to live off it, you have to become very, very good. You know, and that is a multi-year journey. And becoming great when you can really prosper, that takes even longer. And I think you've really captured that in this book, in a lot of the stuff that you've written about. And I hope people get it. I really do. I hope people read it and I hope they understand what you're saying.
Thank you.
Oh, excellent, Steve. I think your mic has gotten to a point now where your voice... Yeah, you won't be listening to your voice with glee when you listen back at the podcast there. It came through very clearly nonetheless. But I mean, perhaps if I can start to sort of wind down on this today. You know, Tom, I think, as I say, that it's quite rare to find people in the market space that get it, you know, that kind of get the sort of the human requirements for trading, physical, mental, and experience level, you know, because all of that's necessary, and getting the balance right for that, as you say, many people rely on the technical so much and kind of forget the fact that they're having no sleep and not hydrated and haven't got mental stability, and yet they're wondering why they're losing money when they're trading. I think you brought a lot of that with some real good practicality and the storytelling, even the Luke Donald Tiger Woods thing, and the there's some interesting stories, and Matthew McConaughey's mentioned in there with sort of a more purposeful statement. And I think that just makes it a very interesting read. So, I mean, I would definitely encourage it. And perhaps, you know, some of the comments on the front, I don't keep on saying that the book is fantastic and it's a great book, believe me, but an assassin showing you how he gets ready for his next hit is kind of what it's all about, right? Yeah. And also, why normal thinking never wins the trading game. And it doesn't. You kind of have to get stuck into the stuff that some people call soft power, emotional intelligence. You know, the bit about you that men seem to find difficult. Women seem to get into that a lot more easier and actually become better traders from what we can kind of work out. So men kind of need to wake up to this fact that there's a soft game they need to pay attention to in whatever way they want to do it. I think your book alludes to that and gives some insight into that. So I think we've got to congratulate you for that. Perhaps, Steve, have you got anything to sort of say at the end there?
Look, books like this come across rarely. And what I love about it is it goes to some of the places rarely explored. And it's based on many years' experience, many years failing. You know, if we look at every single, and it's kills me to see it out there, these YouTube adverts from the various gurus who have probably never traded a day in their life. They're just salespeople out there flogging something and trying to convince people that this job is easy. And real traders, real people who have been through the experiences, knows not only is it not easy, failure and repeated failure is a big part of this journey. And you have to learn to fail. You have to learn to lose. And at the end of the day, the best loser wins.
Dunno. There we go. So let's end on the book title. So fantastic. So, Tom, where can people find you? Where can they track you? Where can they get more info about you? Where can they buy your book?
Well, you know, I think the standard reply is Harriman House or Amazon. Isn't that where we, kind of where we, that's our go-to these days is Amazon. But I'd like to support Harriman House and say they should go there.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. And, you know, I highly recommend going to Harriman House's website where there is a discount currently on the price of the book. And, of course, Amazon is the other option. Also, go to the at Trader Tom, or I think it's Trader Tom website. And Tom has a Telegram channel as well, where he's constantly putting up live data, information about his trading, his thoughts, etc. So thank you, Tom. Thank you again for being such a great guest today. And we look forward to hearing more about your journey in the future. Goodbye. Thank you for listening today. We would like to thank our podcast sponsorship partners, TradeStation Global and the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. You can find out more about our sponsors at our website, alpha-mind.net, or see the link in the episode description. TradeStation Global is a multi-asset trading platform with access to international markets where you can trade a range of instruments from one single account and leverage professional-grade trading tools. Visit tradestation-international.com/alphamind to know more. The Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, provide world-beating technical analysis education programs. AlphaMind podcast listeners can obtain a 10% discount off the cost of their excellent home study course. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, we'd appreciate it if you could leave a friendly review or provide a rating for the show on whichever podcast service you use. You can find out more about us at our website, alpha-mind.net. You can follow us on Twitter at AlphaMind101 and at AlphaMind102. And you can connect with me, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall, on LinkedIn. You can also follow us and can check back over some of our past episodes on the alphamindpodcast.com. We wish you the best of luck in the markets. Have a good week.